please take a seat. And please give a very, very warm welcome to Tim and Rachel. Come on up. The plan is, just as the guys are seated, Tim's going to introduce us a wee bit more to Rachel so we can get to know her before the Q&A time. And I should have mentioned that you can also not just submit questions online, but you can vote which questions you would like to be answered. So you can be voting. If you've got a specific question that catches your interest, then vote for it. And it will be pushed up the list. So that was at pigeonhole.at, and then 6:30 is the passcode. You can be doing that while we're going on. Okay, over to you guys. Thanks.
Thank you, Mark. I guess quite a few of you were at one or the other of the service this morning. So rather than go through the things that we did this morning, I'm just going to pray-see what we said, and there will be an opportunity for more questions than we had this morning, particularly questions from the audience. But suffice it to say, I need to introduce my sister, Rachel, who has for over 30 years travelled to... I asked her, because I wanted to know the answer to that, has worked in over 40 countries in the world, particularly bringing relief after disasters. These are natural disasters, hurricanes, earthquakes, and particularly in war-torn countries. And after about 30 years, as a Christian, she has learnt quite a lot, and I think there's plenty that she can tell us, that she can share with us. This morning we looked a little bit about at why these things happen in the world, or what a Christian's response should be. You know, why is suffering? And I briefly outlined that the Bible, if you read it, is all about suffering. It doesn't run away from the fact that there is suffering and there will always be suffering in this world. And I reminded us that actually at the heart of the gospel is our Lord and Saviour suffering for us. So it's not a subject that we should run away from, although it is a difficult subject for Christians. Now, Alistair has very kindly managed to retrieve the slides which were from this morning. So I'm just going to briefly ask Rachel I'll sit down, I think. just tell us, Rachel, when you left school, what did you do?
Okay, thanks, Tim. So when I left school, I trained as a nurse and then as a midwife. So I had a transferable skill, and I deliberately trained as a nurse and a midwife because I knew I wanted to go and work internationally.
Okay, and what was the first country you worked in?
The very first country I worked in was actually Uganda, and I hated every minute of it. So we'll pass swiftly on from that. I then worked in Iraq with Tear Fund, and I suddenly loved it. And the reason was, when I was in Uganda and I hated it, I was working in a fairly sort of long-term, slow development program. And I found it very difficult to see any change. And that's not to say that change doesn't happen, but it is often long and term and slow. And when I went to Iraq, I worked in a rapid response relief situation with refugees. And that suited me a lot more. That was my type of personality. And I saw a difference in people's lives immediately. So... that's why I knew that I was destined to do aid and relief work rather than longer, slower-term development work.
Okay, so that suited you, the sort of person you are, yeah, and the heart that you have for people in an acute crisis. Now, rather than go through all the places you've been. There were some slides which we showed this morning, and in the second service we hardly showed any of them. And I just thought maybe instead of me asking you questions, we'll just go through your slides and you can speak to the situation that you were in at the time. So shall I just move?
I'll do the clicker. Talking.
Okay.
So this first.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
The first one is to show the position of the country at the bottom of Saudi Arabia, which is Yemen. And many people may not have even heard of Yemen. And if you have heard of Yemen, you know vaguely that there's a war going on in Yemen. Actually, it's the world's worst humanitarian crisis right now. So more than 75% of the population of Yemen, that's 22 million people, rely on aid, humanitarian aid, just to stay alive. And so Yemen is actually the world's worst humanitarian crisis. There is a war going on. It's a very complicated war. It's partly tribal. There's the involvement of Saudi Arabia. There's the involvement of Iran. And there's the UK and the US supporting Saudi Arabia. So it's a very entrenched war, and it's causing immense suffering to the people of Yemen. Next slide. This is the capital city of Yemen, Sana'a, which is now under the control of the Houthi. The Houthis are a rebel movement that came down from the north of Yemen and overthrew the government. Now, that's not to say it was necessarily a good government. It was a pretty terrible government. And many of the people of Yemen were suffering from poor governance in the first place. And the Houthis certainly haven't made things better. They've just created a bigger conflict. The government fled from Sana'a and went to Saudi Arabia. So you have the Yemeni government in exile in Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi Arabians are now heavily bombing Yemen to get rid of the Houthis. And the bombs that they're using are from the US and the UK. And the argument from the Saudi Arabians is that the Houthis are supported by Iran. So you have a sort of proxy war by the superpowers waged over small little Yemen. And the result is, next slide, this is the port of Hodeidah. Yemen is a very poor country, as I said, and prior to the war it relied on 90% of imports, food imports, because they could not produce food to feed their own country. So now that port is being heavily shelled and bombed. And in addition to that, the Saudis blockade the port with their naval ships, so troops and ships with food can't get in. And the next slide shows the result. It's the children of Yemen that are suffering the most. And by the end of this year, in just this year, 250,000 children in Yemen under 5 will die of starvation. And so these are the secondary effects of war. They're not dying from the bombs, but they're dying from the fact that the port is blockaded, food cannot get in, and so they are dying needlessly from hunger. I think we're going to whisk quickly through these just to show a variety of different areas and suffering. This is going back a number of years to the Rwanda genocide, and these are Rwandan refugees fleeing from Rwanda, where there had been a genocide from one tribal movement to the other, the Hutus and the Tutsis. And the Hutus killed the Tutsis, and then the Hutus fled out of their country and lived in refugee camps. Next slide. One of the terrible things about hundreds and thousands of people living in a makeshift camp, it's a bit like a city that is thrown up overnight. And those refugee camps in Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo that fled after the Rwanda genocide, they were makeshift cities with no water, with no sanitation. And, you know, we take for granted the fact that we have clean water, we have health, sanitation here. When you don't have it, one of the most deadly things to happen is cholera. And that picture is actually a cholera bed. And sorry for those of you who are squeamish, but actually cholera is a dreadful disease that you just lose water from both orifices very, very, very quickly, and you die from dehydration. And the only way to treat cholera patients is to have these very simple beds with a hole in it where their water-like feces can just pour through into bucket, and it is very, very, very infectious. So actually, as I was saying, in Yemen, that people die from the starvation in the conflict, actually they also die in Rwanda in refugee camps, not from the war, but from actually diseases spread as a result of war or displacement. Next slide.
Okay.
Clean water. You can't speak about saving lives without talking about water. And, of course, I could talk about the water of life and make a very spiritual sign of it. But actually, clean water and cleanliness, for those who understand public health, is probably the number one priority. One of the most scary things, and maybe someone's going to ask me what scary things in my life, but actually one of the most scary things is child soldiers that I've experienced. And this is a young lad in Sierra Leone. There are many reasons that child soldiers are more scary than adults, not least because they are often taken to be soldiers before they really know anything. They don't know the difference really between right and wrong. They are taught to kill, to kill, to kill, to kill, until it just becomes a reflex. And many of them have actually witnessed terrible atrocities. They may have witnessed their parents being killed. And then they're thrust a Kalashnikov into their hands and told to be a soldier. So they don't know anything else. And I think when you come to a checkpoint and it's manned by child soldiers, you really do fear, because you don't know what they might do. At least with an adult soldier who might have had some modicum of training, you feel that you can reason with them. But with a child, you just don't know. And often they are drugged and really don't know what they're doing. And this is also Sierra Leone. One of the atrocities in Sierra Leone, which again was a predominantly tribal conflict, as so many are in Africa, was the random maiming and killing with machetes. And there was a saying in Sierra Leone that people would be asked if they wanted long sleeves or short sleeves. And if you said long sleeves, you just got your hands chopped off. And if you said short sleeves, then you got amputated at the top. This is Liberia, the country next to Sierra Leone. Many Sierra Leonean refugees fled into Liberia. And I worked in a refugee camp. And again, we had a lot of malnutrition. And there was an opportunity to get the malnourished children to a feeding centre not far away. It was actually only about 10 miles away, but it would take 16 hours to get there in the rainy season because of the mud. As you can see, you might be suffering from malnutrition and the means to help you might be nearby, but when you've got roads like that, it just compounds the problem. And this is a child with malnutrition in Liberia. This slide is in the Caribbean. Many of you might remember 2 years ago, 2017, there was terrible hurricanes in the Caribbean, and we saw the British Virgin Islands and Antigua and some of those wonderful destinations. I think Richard Branson's island, Necker, was badly damaged. But actually, so was this island, Dominica. And Dominica is not an island that has tourism. Dominica doesn't have beautiful sandy beaches. Dominica is an island in the Caribbean that was very, very poor, and the people mostly relied on fishing, and their boats were trashed by the hurricane and their homes were trashed. So it's just another example of a disaster that just takes everything away from people. And this is Afghanistan. This is possibly one of the most beautiful countries I've ever worked in, and this is Kabul. And the next slide is Pakistan. And I always talk about Afghanistan and Pakistan together because they're so intrinsically linked with conflict, but also with very complex political difficulties between the different tribal movements that go completely across the false boundary, really, between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Sorry.
That's right. The past picture was Pakistani children having polio drops, but you can see the guy behind with the gun. The next slide, this is also Pakistan, where there was a terrible earthquake, and you can see how, it's an aerial shot, the houses just pancaked down. And actually, had they been better built, then they might have been able to withstand the earthquake. So again, it's just as an example of how people in countries where they don't have good governance and where there is lawlessness and rules surrounding building and construction and all sorts of norms are just not there, then they suffer way, way more when something happens like that. Anybody recognize this? Hong Kong, somebody said, yeah, Hong Kong. Again, a very, very sort of first world, beautiful city. I worked in Hong Kong a long time ago, and it was when the Vietnamese people fled to Hong Kong, and here they are. They ostensibly fled because Vietnam was under threat of communism and they didn't want to be under communist rule. But actually many, many, many more of them fled because they were poor and they thought that Hong Kong would provide better economic opportunities for them than Vietnam. And this is what they found. They were banged up inside these Nissan huts, surrounded by barbed wire, and they lived on kind of bunk bed shelves inside those Nissan huts. And so the streets of Hong Kong were really not paved with gold for them at all. And they had nothing to do. They had to survive on food and water and rations that were provided for them. And many of them did not want to go back to Hong Kong, to Vietnam, because in Vietnam, it's very, very important to save face. And they'd left telling all their families and relations and friends that they'd gone to Hong Kong and that everything in Hong Kong would be fine. And many of them stayed there for in the camps in Hong Kong for 10 years or more rather than go home and say it was so terrible. They did have to go home when Hong Kong went back to the Chinese after being under British rule. But that's a longer story. And this is Syria.
We've done it.
Yeah, that was just to show you.
Yeah.
And this is a Syrian refugee camp in Jordan. And just to say that the country I'm working on now is Syria. So Syria is the country that's kind of currently on my heart, and probably the one that you hear about more in the news today.
Great, Rachel. That was a nice sort of summary of of lots of things that we, where you've been and the places you've. The things you've seen. And now we'll move on to questions that have come from the audience, from the congregation. And Mark, have you got...
Yeah.
You've got... Will they? Can they come up on the screen? Thanks, Alistair, for those slides.
Thanks, Alistair.
Now, we've got one... that we want to highlight at the start, which might have flowed over from the conversations that were happening this morning. I'm just going to go active with this question here and see if this works. There we go. If the problem in Yemen is a political problem and not a financial one, then why are we raising money for it?
Can I say thank you very much for whoever asked that question, because I totally... set that up for myself this morning by saying that it was a problem of access in Yemen rather than a problem of money. And so very naturally the question is, well, why are we giving money then? As I said, that 75% of the population of Yemen is reliant on aid, and there's an absolute bottleneck of trying to get aid in because the ports have been blockaded. The airports are still open. Sana'a Airport has been heavily bombed by the Syrians, but it's continually repaired. So it's bombed and repaired and bombed and repaired. Not by the Syrians, by
Saudis.
Saudis. Aid cannot get in anything like the amount that is needed. You cannot fly big planes in because the airport is not sufficient to allow large planes to land, but small planes land. So you can get trickles of aid in, but it is not nearly enough to sustain that population. But we continue to try. And the other thing is that money given to Yemen is earmarked for Yemen. So it will have to be used in Yemen. And we continue to hope and to pray and to try to get that blockade lifted, to get the Saudis to stop bombing. And the minute that happens, we need to have food and relief items and aid ready to get into all those ports to feed and save the lives of the Yemenis. So, yes, right now it's a difficulty with access, but we have to believe that that access will come, and then we need the aid to flow. So it is still really important to support it.
Brilliant, thank you. Here's another one I want to highlight. Have you ever doubted in your faith when you have been faced with terrible consequences?
Thank you for that question too. It is awful to see so much suffering. And I think it rocks you and it shakes you. I think that I'd be unhuman if I didn't say I had large questions and big questions. But actually to doubt, no. I think that I have to blindly believe and hold on because it's the only way I can make sense of it. Believing that there's something better, believing that there's something bigger, believing that God does have a plan and a purpose for his world that the Bible tells us to, even though it's more than my mind can comprehend. And actually, being there and being involved is easier and better for me than not being there and knowing it's going on anyway. You know, once you've had your eyes opened and you have a skill and you can do something about it, we all know from our own small world that you feel better when you've helped someone, when you've done something, when you've contributed, when you feel you've made a difference. And maybe in some small way, that is my purpose, mm-hmm. in God's bigger purpose. So I think for me, it's just focusing what I know I can do, the relief, the hope, the love, the joy I can bring to that one person and change their life, then that's what I have to focus on and do. It's a bit of a small answer to a big question, yeah. But...
Great. And it, I guess, flows on to our next question. How do we, as Christians in the West, interact with those who have encountered war in a way that is attuned to their past experiences if we ourselves have been desensitized to the realities of war?
Oh, great question. Well, I guess the short answer is we can't possibly even begin to hope and think that we can. I think that we have to recognize that we are not the ones who are suffering, who are there. It is not our concept, our understanding at all. So we cannot have that sort of paternalistic, we know best attitude. What we can do is partner with local people. And this is what Tear Fund does really well. Tear Fund partners with local churches, people that understand the culture, that understand the context, that have been through things themselves. And we enable and provide and help local partners, certainly Tear Fund does, to do that. One thing I will add is that culture and context is incredibly important. And I'm not a child psychologist, but I have seen when I went to the Rwanda genocide, where many children were deeply traumatized from what they had witnessed, some really culturally inappropriate attempts to help those children get through their trauma. And these attempts were from people who had learned from Bosnia that working with Bosnian children following the war, they could help Bosnian children by using marionettes or puppets to reenact scenes and situations from war that helped the children come through the trauma. Trying to translate that into a Rwanda context did not work at all, because the Rwandans had no idea of puppets and marionettes. So I think it's just a small example as to how you have to be incredibly culturally aware and understand that actually we need people who are local from those countries to do these things and not ourselves.
Yeah, great. Thank you. And here's a question that asks a wee bit about you. What is your background, Rachel? What led you to this career path? How would you encourage others with interest?
Well, my background, as I said at the beginning, that I trained as a nurse and a midwife. I think that prior to that, there's an important fact, and that is that I was born in Africa. To me, I think I remember growing up as a small child, always, always wanting to go back to Africa. And maybe Tim too, who also happened to be born in Africa. So I think that gave me something, and Tim something, about a bigger desire about wanting to see this continent where we had been born. So I think that was inherent in me, and I think it's inherent in some, but it's not inherent in everybody. And I can remember at school talking to my friends about, you know, when we left school and I wanted to go to be a nurse and go to Africa. And people would look at me like, why? Because they actually just, you know, wanted to stay in southeast of England and have a family. And that's also fine, you know. If that's what's you, that's what's you. So you have to find your own path and what your own desires and callings are, because they're God-given, I believe. How to encourage others? Do you know, it's very, very different now than it was 30 years ago. It was much easier for me to get into aid work than it is now. So I'll be honest about that. Partly because there are so many people who want to do this kind of work. But there are also very, very good organisations like Tear Fund. And I would say, contact them, ask them, find out. It was Tear Fund that gave me the first opportunity to go and work. And it is a sort of chicken and egg situation right now, because most organisations don't want somebody to come and work with them unless they've got experience. And how do you get experience unless an organisation will give you that opportunity? So that's why I say, you know, contact Tear Fund, get involved, find out if there's an opportunity to go and visit for a short term to a country nearby. You know, there are many countries in Africa that are not disaster areas. Go there, read, get involved with groups, get involved in prayer groups for particular countries of the world that you're interested in, and just push lots of doors.
Mm-hmm. And would you be around afterwards? Do you need to rush away after, Rachel, or would you be around afterwards to chat if anyone has got this interest or God has put it in their hearts? Would you have time afterwards?
Of course. No, yeah. Of course.
I could encourage you to do so and just ask Rachel more questions along that line if that's helpful for you. Here's an interesting question. As bad as the situation is, with over 99% of the population in Yemen practicing Muslims, is sending money to the area the best use of our resources when so many Christians are suffering worldwide?
Again, a great question. I'll be completely honest here. This money is actually about saving lives. So it's where are the greatest needs? And as I said, Yemen is currently the country with the greatest humanitarian need. People just need this money to stay alive. And I think as Christians, we're not interested at that point about whether they're Christian or whether they're Muslim or whether they're Jewish. Actually, it's about their life and their life that is precious. And, you know, God calls us to value others. And if this is where the area of the greatest need is, then that's where we should be putting our emergency money to save lives.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Okay, next question. How do you make sure that this relief is not just a way of promoting Western principles and beliefs, but rather a way to develop peace and allow local populations choose Christ for themselves?
I think there's two bits to this. There's the bit about choosing Christ for themselves. I think that at this point, when we're saving lives, we are saving lives, but we're not proselytizing. Tear Fund does not proselytize in Islamic countries, in Muslim countries. It wouldn't be appropriate to do so, and it would probably get them thrown into jail. So Christian organizations do not proselytize in countries like this. What they do is they go and save a life. And if you save a life, then you open up an opportunity for people to ask, well, why? Why did you come from that country where you had food and you had water and you had shelter? Why did you come to this country to save my life? And then you have an opportunity to talk about a God that loves. But the first imperative is actually to save the life.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Jesus would have done.
Could you share any opportunities you've had or stories that you've had where that conversation has flowed over from the relief work that you've been involved in, where they've approached you and asked about your faith? And
yeah, I mean, there have been a number of occasions when I have been asked that question, like, why would you come here when you didn't have to? And people have said, you know, we wouldn't be here if we didn't have to. We didn't have a choice. This is our country, and our country was overcome by conflict. So why would you choose to come? And I've just said that because I do believe that there is a God who loves us all, and just because, you know, he happened to bless me by being in a country that was safe, that also gave me a responsibility to go to others that were less fortunate than myself and to share that love that God has for everybody in this world. And I think, you know, you have to remember that I'm also usually talking through a translator. Mm-hmm. I don't often speak the language of the country that I've gone to, and particularly if it's an Islamic country, then you have to be incredibly sensitive to what you say, not just for your own safety, but for the other person's safety. And I think at that very pointy end of saving a life, it's actually, that's probably about as much as you can say and do. You know, that's mm-hmm. the nugget, right?
Yeah.
I'm not there to start there and you give a Bible study from, you know, one of the Gospels about what Jesus has done for them. I don't feel that that's always the most appropriate time or moment. But what you do is pass on the love of God, and then you have to kind of trust that that may be something that leads to something more in that person's life.
Okay, thank you. Here's another question, if it's coming up. Is there a difference between relief and mission?
Yes, I guess that's probably partly what I've just talked about, really. I mean, I'm very definitely involved in relief work, which is saving lives and relieving suffering. That's as simple as it saves lives, and it relieves human suffering. You actually, I believe if somebody is starving, then what they need first is food. They need to be given the means to stay alive before you can have a conversation about the mission. And as I said earlier, there are times when it's perhaps easier to have that conversation and go farther, and there are times when it's not. But you still do the life-saving, and you wait and see what other opportunities that might bring. Mm-hmm. But to me, I think this is where relief work is predominantly about saving somebody's life. But the reason I go and the reason I'm there to save their life is because I do believe in a big God who's asked me to go and do that.
And personally, do you ever get scared?
Yeah, so I did tell you about the very scary checkpoints. I think, you know, they are the scary things of the child soldiers. There have been two other times when I thought I might die, and I was quite scared. And both of those occasions were in Bosnia in the war, and I worked for the Red Cross. And one of those occasions was driving my armoured Land Rover, which was, I knew, safe because it was armoured. But working for the Red Cross, one of the symbols that we believe protects us from getting involved in the conflict is the emblem of the Red Cross. And we always had a Red Cross flag, so it's a white background with a Red Cross fluttering at the back of the Land Rover. And I was driving over this big mountain coming into Sarajevo, and I could see that the flag had got wound around the flagpole. And you're very exposed on this mountain. So I thought, I better get the flag unfurled so that people can see it, so that I don't get shot at by snipers. They can see that this is the Red Cross Land Rover. So I got out to run around the flag, unfurl the flag, and this shots came flying over my head. They were warning quite clearly, because actually they could have killed me. So I just jumped back in the Land Rover and thought, never mind the flag, let's just stay inside the armoured Land Rover. So that was scary, but it was also probably a bit stupid.
There was another one.
Yeah, there was another one. Shall I tell
you? Oh, yes, please. Please do.
The other one is probably equally stupid. I was with my translator, and we were in a market on the other side of the front line. So there are front lines that you have to crisscross. So we were in an area of the war zone that was really not particularly hospitable, but they had good meat in the market, and we needed meat. So my translator, Boris, had gone out to buy meat, and I was just staying in the armoured Land Rover, and a very, very, very drunk soldier came up with his gun, and he put it at the windscreen right beside me where I was in the driver's seat. And I knew it was a bulletproof glass, but I didn't really know whether a gun at point-blank range right up against the glass would shatter the glass. I didn't really know what would happen. I was very scared. And my foot was going like this on the clutch, and I wasn't sure what to do because Boris was buying meat. and I thought, I can't go because I have to wait for Boris. But then I could see him signalling. I could see Boris signalling that he was safe, he was in a shop, and that I should go. So I kind of managed to control my foot and reverse out of there as fast as I could. And he didn't shoot.
And you live to tell the tale. Okay, here we go. I think we've got time for a couple more questions. Once this wakes up. In what way is the UK government involved? And how can petitioning MPs make a difference?
Really good question. So I mentioned in passing that the war in Yemen is now a much wider conflict, and the great superpowers are involved, and Saudi is supported by both the US and the UK that sell weapons to the Saudis. Now, if they didn't, then the Saudis would no way have the know-how to be bombing Yemen to the degree and sophistication that they are doing. Okay, the war in Yemen has been now going on for 5 years. In 2014, it was probably a pretty unheard of argument to raise in Parliament that the UK should not be contributing weapons to the Saudis. Right now, 5 years on, that's shifted a bit, because a lot of people have been writing to their MPs. More information is getting out there that actually we are implicated in that war in Yemen. So the more people can see pictures of those starving children and the fact that, you know, our government is involved, the more pressure can come to bear. And, you know, I think that our government is beginning to shift. And that's why I do believe that there will come a time when the blockade is lifted. The Saudis will not be able to continue that. They're losing a huge amount of money. They're losing... there are a number of reasons why the Saudis are under pressure, not least the murder of the Khashoggi guy, but the war in Yemen as well. This is unsustainable. So I think if we can continue to put pressure on our MPs, there is a possibility that we could change the dynamics, particularly of the UK's involvement. The US is another matter. We don't have quite so much influence, but they do. And that could change things. So, yes, I do think it's really important to write for MPs. And I will say one more thing. Yeah. Because I work for the British government, it's really important to know that not everybody who works for the government believes the same thing. So our Ministry of Defence might be really pleased that they've got this big fat contract with the Saudis to supply weapons. Our Department for International Development that I work for absolutely is not pleased, because we're trying to get money in to save the children who are dying because the Ministry of Defence is spending money, is sending bombs to kill them. Yeah. So we are conflicted in government. And then we also have our Foreign Office that is more concerned about our relationship with Saudi Arabia. But it's also concerned about our relationship with all the other countries. So all these things, there's a very careful interplay of relationships and interests. And when the balance tips between it being more beneficial to us to not support the Saudis against that war, then we'll see a change.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. Okay, last question, I think, from this board. How do young people with a passion in relief and mission, etc., get involved? Where do we start? You've touched on this already.
I did.
But would you add anything else?
Again, another plug for Tearfund, I think. I really do think Tearfund is a very good organisation, not only because it was what launched me, but I think Tearfund is incredibly professional. They get very involved in advocacy. So when I was talking about writing to your MP, Tearfund is very much involved in encouraging that sort of thing, getting people to sign petitions, go on marches, get politically active. That's not a sort of unchristian thing to do. Mm-hmm. Of course we need to pray, and of course we need to continue to think about the mission angle and the way that we can help churches to get involved. But actually, we also need to think wider than just that and think about the power of our own voices in a country that has democracy to get engaged, sign petitions, go on marches, write your MP. When you feel that something really hits your conscience, then do that. And I think Tearfund is very good at giving you advice on how to do things like that.
Brilliant. Rachel, how has this journey impacted your own faith? Do you have are there verses of scripture that you've found particularly helpful as God has called you to these different places?
Yeah, thanks. There's actually one verse that has always meant a lot to me, and that is, trying to remember the actual reference. I know the verse. Someone can shout out the reference when I give you the verse. It's, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all, thank you. Proverbs 3, verse. Thank you. So I'll say it again. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him and he will make your paths straight. And to me, you know, that means, as I've answered in these questions, I will not have all the answers, because there are some of these things that are just way too big for me and too difficult for my small mind to understand. But all I have to do is trust in the Lord. So trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding, because we can't understand it. In all your ways, acknowledge him and he will make your path straight. So whatever you do, do it for him. And as I said, I don't proselytize. I'm working now in a political sphere. I don't proselytize at all. I don't bring the gospel in a mission sense. But I'm leaning on, I'm trusting in the Lord with all my heart and leaning on not my understanding, but his. And then he is the one who guides me what to do next and makes my path straight. And actually, I don't know what impact what I've done has, and I may never know, but he does, and that's what matters.
Fantastic. Rachel, thank you so much for coming and sharing with us and answering these questions as well so gracefully. As we've already said, I'm sure Rachel would love to chat to you afterwards if you've got other questions or would like to follow up. From something that she's already shared. Rachel, we're going to have a time just now just in prayer. Just in prayer. I didn't mean just in prayer. It's funny how we say that. Let's just pray. We don't mean that, do we? Let's pray, because that is the most important thing we can do. Let's have a time in prayer. But Rachel, if there are, what can we be praying for you? But also, are there any topics just now that you would appreciate prayer for in your work as well?
Well, I do think, because we've talked a lot about Yemen and we've given money for Yemen, I actually do think we should pray for a lifting of the blockade, for food and relief to get into Yemen, and for the softening of the hearts of our leaders. And I do believe that's something that we should pray for. I think there is potential for change there. I do think that there is potential for the Saudi bombardment of Yemen to come to an end. So I think we should pray for wisdom for leaders to see a different way. So for Yemen, for sure.
Okay, and personally?
And for me personally, or just for the grace, I think, to continue working wherever is right for me to be next. At the moment, as I say, I'm in London, which is really, really nice. But wherever we go next, that, you know, by God's grace, we, and my husband is with me, that we know where to go and what is next and what to do and all of those kind of practical things. Because my husband also works in relief work. He works for the United Nations. So we go together.
Right.
And also, Rachel, there were two prayers that you had, you've always had, which would carry on, which was to maintain your compassion and
wisdom. So, yes, the two prayers I've always asked God in my work, as always, that I would not lose the compassion, because it's quite easy for aid workers to become inured to the pain and the suffering that they see. And you do see people become hard, and I don't want to become hard, and wisdom to deal with issues, that situations that come up that I've never seen before, because that even happens after 30 years all the time. So I need a lot of wisdom.
Brilliant. Let's pray for these things. For Rachel, for compassion, for wisdom, and also for direction. And for Yemen, for the leaders, that God will change their hearts.
And lift the blockade. Yeah.
And lift the blockade. Brilliant. Let's pray to our big God, our great big God, about these things. And if you're comfortable, why not turn to people around you and pray together in small groups. If you're uncomfortable, you can pray yourself, or just close your eyes and pretend you're praying. But let's turn to each other if you're comfortable, and let's spend a time in prayer.